I'm happy now to welcome to the program Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University. She's a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Her most recent book is Complexity, A Guided Tour, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So complexity is one of those words, we've got a lot of words, complexity and chaos and emergence and things that are hard to define. So I thought maybe we could start with giving some examples of complex systems.
Right, yeah, complexity is always very hard to define. But the field of complex systems studies all kinds of systems ranging from the brain to the immune system, to cells, to ant colonies, to social networks, and the whole financial market system. And it's just a very broad set of topics, but people are trying to find some of the common tools and common principles by which these systems operate.
Now, one of the things that seems, well, that's interesting about them is that a lot of these systems that you've mentioned operate with some basic, fairly simple principles that give rise to incredibly complicated behavior.
That's one of the commonalities of all these systems, is that you can talk about them in terms of their individual components, like the immune system has individual cells, the brain has individual neurons, ant colonies have ants, economic systems have people who buy and sell. And the rules by which these individuals operate and communicate with each other are very relatively simple compared with the behavior of the system as a whole. And one of the things that people who study complex systems have found is that it's very difficult to understand and predict these systems just by looking at collections of the individual components. And the global behavior of the system seems to be, it's an example of that old phrase, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And that's what people mean by this term emergence. It's kind of a fuzzy term, but it's meant to mean that the complex behavior we see of all of these systems is in some sense bigger than the sum of all the components.
I think there's something that happens when you start looking at things closely where they start to become really amazing, like an ant colony. Ants are not known for being all that smart.
Right.
But the things that ant colonies do and the way that they work together is extraordinary. And, I mean, do we know how a group of ants can, I mean, obviously they don't have architectural plans that they draw. They don't have, do they have language with which they communicate to each other? Do they have group mind?
Well, that's a good question, and it's not totally understood how they do all the things that they do. We know that they have a kind of language that consists of communicating with each other via chemical signals and also by sensing chemicals on the bodies of other ants that ants touch. And each ant has very simple behavior, and if you put an ant all by itself, it's not going to do anything complex at all. But as you said, when you get a lot of them together, they can build these incredible colonies with lots of different rooms that are temperature controlled and, you know, sheltering the infant ants and the queen. They can do things like figure out in some way, collectively, what each ant should be doing, how many ants should be out foraging for food, how many ants should be protecting the colony, how many ants should be taking care of the babies, and so on. And somehow they figure out sort of the best balance, the best way of allocating these tasks in the colony.
And as far as we know, there's not some ant director saying, okay, now I need two of you over there and 10 of you over here.
Yeah, we know that there is no director. Yeah. And that's another thing that's common in all these complex systems that we look at. We know in the brain there's no central controller that tells all the neurons what to do. Or in the economy, there's no central controller, at least in capitalist systems, that's telling everybody what to buy and what to sell and how much they should buy and sell it for. And in all these systems, somehow they become organized and adaptive. You know, they improve their performance as a whole collectively without having any controller. And that's one of the very surprising things about all these systems.
Let's take another example. Somebody once was telling me about birds flocking behavior. And there's no one leader that says to the birds, okay, we're going to take a left now or whatever. And yet they fly in very consistent ways. And with birds, there are a couple of very simple rules, like don't bang into each other.
Right, and follow what your neighbor does. And don't bang into each other. And people have built little computer programs that simulate bird flight just by each simulated bird having these simple rules. And it's very reminiscent of real birds. And people even use this in like computer animation and movies, these kind of biological principles of collective behavior.
And so a couple of rules like that, which in birds and probably fish schooling and things like that are pretty easy to discern what they are, in things like the ant colony, can we figure out what the ant rules are?
People are figuring out some of them. There's a number of people who study ants. That's their career, and have found some of the rules that they follow. Not all of them. Ant behavior is much more complicated. The behavior of ant colonies is more complicated than birds flocking. And nobody really understands all of the things that ants do.
So how did the study of complex systems begin?
It goes back, way back, actually. The very beginnings of the computer age, you know, in the late 1940s, people were already starting to think about this kind of thing, about how very complicated systems, like the ones I mentioned, might have something in common with each other. And that was one of the first times that many different disciplines came together to try and find common principles. And there was this whole movement called the cybernetics movement. And they were trying to study what people in complex systems study today, but that movement kind of fizzled out for various reasons. And then only when computers got a lot more powerful so that people could really run simulations of complex systems did complex systems become now sort of a new, very active field. And so I would say that was around the late 70s, early 80s, and that the Santa Fe Institute, in fact, was formed in 84 by a number of people in different fields who really wanted to study these systems from different disciplinary perspectives.
And what were the first things that were studied at the Santa Fe Institute?
I think the very first topic was economics. And they actually got some funding from Citibank at that time to have a number of workshops called The Economy as Adaptive Self-Organizing System, something like that. And they got physicists, economists, mathematicians, and a few other fields to come together and try and say, what can different perspectives sort of contribute to studying something so complex as the economy, which nobody understands, even economists. And so they produced a lot of new ideas that have actually had a lot of impact in economics, even to this date.
Like what?
Well, this whole idea of decentralized control and how most theoretical economists use these mathematical models in which they modeled people as being perfectly rational and able to sort of knowing everything about what other people were going to do, and the mathematics works out really well, but it doesn't really describe what really happens.
You don't think everybody in the world is absolutely 100% rational?
Well, I think that perhaps there's a few of us who aren't quite as rational. So
I mean, can a model take irrationality into account? Is that what they were doing?
That's exactly what they were doing. And they found that instead of using these very elegant mathematical formulas to predict what happens, instead they would build these computer models in which you actually have a model of a buyer and a seller and an auction, and they would model it very explicitly. And this has been now dubbed agent-based modeling as opposed to, I don't know, equation-based modeling or something else, where you explicitly simulate each individual and see how, and instead of solving equations, you run a computer program and see how what comes out.
So were there actual auctions and markets which scientists went to and observed behavior and made models based on things that they saw in real life?
Yes, absolutely. And they had one of the very first products of the Santa Fe Institute, scientific products, was something called the artificial stock market, which was a simulation of the stock market that was built collaboratively by economists, physicists, and mathematicians. And it simulated the stock market and was able to simulate things like bubbles and crashes and a lot of the things that we might call emergent behavior coming out of the stock market that we can't predict very well.
And those things are hard to predict because human beings are hard to predict on some level. But for example, in the recent stock market bubble bursting or whatever you want to call it, the things that were really going on there were deregulation, dishonesty, inordinate risk-taking, callous disregard for the good of the whole, and things like that. You model those things.
In principle, if you could model them, that it's that kind of human behavior is hard to capture in a model, but I think people are working on it. And in fact, George Soros, who you may know, famous...
Not personally, but
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, right, famous finance guy, has created basically a foundation to fund these very large-scale agent-based models of financial markets that might capture some of the things that people are missing during, so that they couldn't predict the last finance crash. So this is a big area now, and it really, I think, largely started and was sort of made accessible by the work at SFI back in the 80s.
We're talking to Melanie Mitchell, professor at Santa Fe Institute, about complexity. So one of the things that is almost counterintuitive, at least to me, is that you've got things like the immune system, which is a kind of microscopic thing where you can't really consider an immune cell an individual the way you might consider a person or a mouse an individual. Then you've got social behavior. Then you've got things like the weather and clouds. And all of these operate on similar principles. Is that right?
Well, I don't know. It's I think there's a difference between systems like the weather and climate predictions and systems like the immune system. There's a difference between living systems and non-living systems.
Right.
And that living systems have this property that they're trying to survive, to learn, to adapt, and to evolve, where non-living systems don't have those properties. And I think that really does set up kind of a fundamental difference. But within living systems, as you said, there's an incredible breadth of living systems. And, if you want to call, for example, societies kind of a living system, it's very different than the immune system in some ways, but in other ways, there's some commonalities. And one of the ways people have studied that is by studying networks. So, we're familiar with networks. We have the internet, we have social networks like Facebook and so on. But you can also think about the immune system as a kind of network where instead of people having links to other people, you have cells that have links to other cells because they send each other messages. And you can map out the network of the immune system, and then you can look at what that network looks like. And in some ways, it's very, it has some similar properties to other kinds of networks, like social networks.
So give us some examples of networks and how, through this study of complex systems, you begin to understand what their interactions are all about.
So one example would be, for instance, the network of Facebook, let's say, where you have individual people and they have friends, and those friends have friends, and so on. And so a person is linked to another person if they're friends, let's say. Another example would be the World Wide Web. So you have web pages, and they have links to other web pages, and so on. And so a web page is linked to another web page if, you know, there's an actual hyperlink from one page to the other. And it turns out if you look at how many people have one friend, how many people have two friends, how many people have, and so on, you know, up to hundreds and hundreds of friends, you find that there's a certain kind of distribution where there's a lot of people with a small number of friends and much fewer people with many, many, many friends. And it turns out that the web has the same kind of distribution, that there's a lot of web pages with small number of links to them, where there's a very small number of web pages with a huge number of links to them, like, you know, Google or something like that. And those two networks have the same kind of distribution in that sense. And then if you look at the brain as a network, you say a neuron is linked to another neuron if they're connected by a synapse. And then you look at how many neurons have one connection, you know, small number of connections, a large number of connections, and people have actually mapped this all out for some simple organisms like worms. It has the same kind of distribution. So all these networks have the same kind of distribution. And that's telling us something about... And those these networks were not... None of these networks were designed to have this distribution. They just
got
evolved
that way.
Got that way somehow. And so that tells us something about how networks might be formed and, you know, why... Then we can ask, why do they have this kind of distribution? What kind of properties does it have? It turns out it makes the network more robust to certain kinds of failures. And you see that in a lot of different contexts. And people are really excited now about these findings from what's called network science, which is just across many different disciplines, finding a lot of similarities in network structure.
And so do we understand, so for example, with Facebook, I mean, some people don't use it that much and they have a few friends. Some people use it crazily and do all kinds of things with it, and they have a lot of friends and a lot of different kind of connection to different pages. So what does that translate to, if we know, in the human brain? So in other words, okay, the neuron that is responsible for remembering the plot of the Aeneid has like one connection to it. But the one that is interested in food has gazillions. I mean,
yeah, well, I think you've nailed the reason that there's this principle that people in network science talk about that's the rich get richer, which means that if you have more connections than somebody else, you're more likely to get even more connections. So, you know, if you have a lot of friends on Facebook, you're going to get more friends probably than the person who has fewer friends. The same thing with neurons, that, you know, if you have a lot of connections, then you're getting activated a lot more, which brings in even more connections. So that principle seems to hold in all these different networks.
Having begun to understand that, and I know that this is a science that has so much that is unknown, and maybe we can talk about are the areas that are really ripe for study. Where does that get you? In other words, what do you do with that information?
Well, some of this information is just interesting from a scientific point of view when you're trying to understand natural systems and how they come to be the way they are. It also, if we study this and see how sort of undesigned networks come to have the kind of structure they have that turns out to be very robust and has some desirable properties about how long it might take for one person in the network to communicate with somebody who's, you know, connected by a number of different links, we can then start to design networks that have the desirable properties that we want because we now know how to put them together.
But why would you have to design them? They seem to emerge all by themselves.
Some of them do. Some of them are designed. Like, for instance, the internet, in some sense, has, which is just the network of computers that connects us all together and lets us send email and so on. That's been largely designed. The power grid of, say, the U.S., that is all the electrical substations and links to where power lines go and what the connections look like, that's also been designed. And so you might ask, what's the best way to design a system like that so that you won't have massive failures? Similar with the economy. And so you can start to understand, in general, in networks, what design principles are good and how do we avoid having a massive failure like the one we just had in the economy.
Right. Now, one of the things that I was thinking about when you were talking is, you know, you said the rich get richer. That is something that applies literally to the economy when it's not regulated. And, I mean, let's talk about the ant colony, and then let's talk about the economy. In an ant colony, some ants live, some ants die, but they all do their thing for the greater good.
Right.
In an economic system, some people are basically sacrificed by the system if you don't have other kinds of regulation and other kinds of structures outside of a capitalist economy. And I guess if you come at it from a completely free market point of view and let the economy work the way it naturally works, which may be on some level is some of the same principles as ant colonies, some people are sacrificed and who cares?
Yes, so that's right. And in fact, people have found that, you know, people assumed that free market policies would actually lead to the greater good of everyone. But they haven't. And so one question is why? What's missing? And, you know, the theory that, like, people like Milton Friedman or whoever invented say that free market economics should not need any regulation. So why do we see that it's failing? And regulation seems to be needed. And that means that network is in some sense a little more complex or more unpredictable than maybe ant colonies. And that may be because of this extra thing we humans have, which is that we respond to complex sets of incentives. And so understanding that might help governments understand what kinds of incentives will get what kind of behavior.
Are there any examples of that come to mind?
Well, okay, so we saw that, as you said, risk-taking, you know, if you take too much risk, if you don't have to pay for taking all that risk, if it just comes for free, like it did with the people who were doing these mortgage security kinds of things, it'll just spiral out of control. And so in some sense, you have to put a tax on risk-taking. And I think that's something that kind of was in place for a while and then
got deregulated out of existence.
Right, and then we saw what happened.
We're talking to Melanie Mitchell, professor of computer science and professor at the Santa Fe Institute, about complexity. What does all this tell us, if it tells us anything, about consciousness? So, for example, when you have a a group like a beehive or an ant colony that does seem to have some kind of group mind where the parts are more than the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And indeed, in human in the human mind, certainly the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, if those parts are neurons, and human society even greater than the individual members of that society. What does it tell us about the nature of mind or consciousness?
So that's a hard question. Consciousness is one of those words, like complexity, that's hard to define. And people say sort of, you know it when you see it. But I don't know, it's very controversial what's conscious and what's not. And I don't think consciousness is an all or nothing phenomenon. I think there's really degrees of consciousness. Like, in some sense, we humans are more conscious than worms. And I don't mean to be arrogant, but that's something that I think most people would agree on.
Although most worms might not agree.
That's true. And who knows? They may be right. But I guess the only thing I can really say about that is that what complex systems shows us is that very, very complicated and I'll say complex behavior can arise from simple parts and simple interactions. And so I don't think there has to be anything extra in the brain besides neurons and neuron interactions to have something like consciousness. And not everyone believes that. In fact, a lot of people find it very hard to believe that we can have such intelligence and consciousness coming out of a substrate that's not intelligent and not conscious, namely, you know, just individual neurons.
Is there an analogy to evolution itself in the sense that through some very simple principles like natural selection, we get this incredible, crazy, robust diversity of life on Earth from pretty simple elements?
Yes. So evolution is something that people in complex systems are very interested in. And not just biological evolution, but evolution, cultural evolution, technological evolution. And, you know, a lot of people sort of see Darwin in a lot of different guises in these different disciplines. But I think that is, in some sense, the most mysterious and unsolved question in biology and maybe in complex systems, which is how does something so simple like natural selection give rise to something so complicated like us? And that just never fails to amaze me when I learn more and more about how biology works, is how complicated it is. And how did natural selection come up with it? Yeah, I think it's a mystery.
What are you working on at the Santa Fe Institute right now?
Well, my field is computer science, and I work on artificial intelligence. And I'm actually right now working on the problem of machine vision, which is getting computers to interpret images or visual scenes. And what I'm trying to do is integrate a model of vision in the brain, what we know about how the brain's visual system works, with higher level cognitive ideas about how concepts work, and try to get those to work together to kind of bridge this gap that we have now between our knowledge of what the brain does and our knowledge of what, in some sense, the mind does. And there's a big gap there.
You've also worked on analogies, which kind of bridge that gap.
Yes, and in fact, this work is really connected to that old analogy work. So analogy means being able to take your knowledge of one area and understand something else in terms of what you understand about the old thing. And in fact, that's how we learn in general. We learn about something new by understanding it in terms of something that's old. And so that's something that I think is really fundamental to cognition. And there's an interesting set of ideas in linguistics that show that the way we think is really embedded in metaphor. So, for instance, we say things like, I'm boiling over with rage. And so we have this sort of image that rage or anger is like sort of a boiling cauldron. And we have other kinds of metaphors like that that are just fundamental to language. And it just gives a window into how we think and how it's based on really physical and spatial ideas.
And those things, which come so naturally to us, actually require a great deal of what you might call thought and decoding to be understood from a scientist's point of view.
Yes. It's really hard to understand it. And that's one of the big challenges in artificial intelligence. In some sense, the things that come the most naturally to us as humans are the hardest things to do in artificial intelligence because the mechanisms are so hidden from us. We don't know how we look at a picture and understand and immediately see, oh, this is a picture of a child's birthday party, something like that. We just don't know how we do that. And no computer can do anything like
that.
There's
a cake. There's a hat.
Yeah. Or, you know, but you can also have a cake and a hat without having a birthday party.
There's candles on the cake. They're blowing them.
Yeah. So there's lots of different concepts going on there. But in general, computer programs can't do that yet. And that's going to be really hard, much harder than, you know, answering questions on Jeopardy, like this famous computer Watson was doing.
Right. Melanie, you're about to teach this course called Exploring Complexity in Science and Technology from a Santa Fe Institute perspective. And the course has no prerequisites. You don't need to know math or science to take this course. It's really for anybody, any professional, from journalists to doctors, anybody at all, lawyers. Besides being endlessly interesting, what can they get out of it? What can somebody taking this course bring back to their own fields of study?
What they can bring back is, number one, sort of a new way of thinking about the world, this whole perspective of complexity. And second, a number of tools that one can use for sort of addressing complex problems in different fields. So computer tools, conceptual tools, and basically a lot of information about what people are actually doing at the forefront of these different areas.
What are some ways in which the study of complex systems actually is used or can be used in real life to solve problems that can't be solved through other ways of thinking?
There's some very new work at the Santa Fe Institute now on looking at the dynamics and complexity properties of cities. And this is work done by Jeffrey West and Luis Bettencourt. It's actually gotten a lot of press because it's very, very interesting and relevant. And what they're doing is they're looking at huge data sets about different attributes of cities and how those different attributes sort of change as the population of the city changes, as the density of housing changes, and other things. So the idea is, I'll give you a couple examples. One of the things they found is that as the population changes, gets bigger, here's a really kind of trivial example, but the speed at which people walk goes up. People walk faster in bigger cities. And the way that it changes, so if you plotted population versus walking speed, you'd get a certain increasing graph. But then if you also looked at how, say, carbon footprint of an individual changes in a city as the population changes, you would find that the changes, the way that plot looks is actually kind of similar. And what they're finding is a lot of these properties have very similar plots. And that points to some underlying reason for the way that, as they say, scaling takes place. Scaling is how one thing, like the speed of walking, changes as another thing, like population size changes. And they found a lot of interesting and kind of counterintuitive results about how cities work and how they're efficient in some ways when there's a bigger population and they're inefficient in some ways. And so I think a lot of city planners have gotten really interested in this work because it points to some new ideas about how to reduce pollution, how maybe to mitigate carbon footprint, and a lot of other things that are of concern to people in cities.
Now, I thought, and I know very little about this, but I thought people's carbon footprint went down when they were in cities because they walked into public transportation, at least in cities like New York.
That's true, and there's other reasons also. In that it's
smaller apartments.
Why it's more efficient to live in cities in terms of energy use. And in fact, Weston, Betancourt and others have found is that, in fact, the efficiency of living in a city goes up much faster than you would expect with the population size. And you can look at the reasons for that, and I don't think they're completely understood. And it might point to ways in which, say, smaller cities might become more efficient because they could enact some of the same principles that are kind of emergent in bigger cities. And I think that's one sort of very recent and very interesting example with a lot of potential for application.
You talk in the introduction about your book about the moving away from reductionist thinking in science to complex thinking in science. And I was wondering if you could just explain reductionism versus complex systems thinking.
Right. So reductionism is the idea that you have a complex system or a complex problem that you want to solve, and you take it apart into parts. And then you study the individual parts. So sort of like you're trying to fix your car. You know, it has certain parts. And you say, okay, maybe the carburetor's having problems or the transmission or whatever. You kind of take it apart and you figure out which part is causing the problem. And then you replace that part. That's kind of a reductionist approach. And it's extremely useful, as we all know, in a lot of situations. And it's driven science for hundreds and hundreds of years.
But a car is not a complex system. It doesn't emerge, it doesn't change, it doesn't learn.
That's right. And so it turns out in some systems, you know, as we said, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, which means that in some cases you can't take it apart and understand it by understanding the individual parts.
Like the ant.
Right. You have to know how the whole system interacts. And it leads to some different ways of thinking about science and about solving problems. And there are these, you know, buzzwords of linear thinking versus nonlinear thinking. And this has come sort of under the guise of nonlinear thinking, when you assume linear just means that you can add up all the parts and figure out what the whole thing is going to do. Whereas nonlinear thinking is when you need to understand a lot more about the interactions of what's going on.
What are the biggest complex systems that people study, and what are the most microscopic or small complex systems?
That's interesting. And I would say people have different definitions of what is a complex system. So some people might say that, you know, actually the universe is a complex system, and we can look at the distribution of galaxies and find interesting network patterns and so on. I don't see that myself as a complex system. So I would say that, you know, the biggest systems that people are looking at have to do with sort of global societies where the individuals are people and the interactions, you know, there's many, many kinds of interactions. The most microscopic, that's also hard to say where you should stop. I mean, people are studying molecular interactions, the interactions of proteins in a cell. When you look at the study of metabolism, that's a big area in complex systems. So I think it goes, you know, the different areas that people look at span a huge number of scales.
Part of the whole study of complex systems is writing computer programs that imitate real life. And that is an ever-changing and ever, I guess, refining process is always going on with that. What are some of the most, to you, interesting areas in which those models are being made and working in some way?
There's a lot of areas. One that we haven't talked about is, say, models of traffic. That's something that a lot of people are interested in. Can you actually, because traffic's obviously a big problem in a lot of places, and some people have developed these very large-scale models of traffic in certain cities like Houston or L.A., where the traffic's just horrible. And they found a lot of sort of emergent phenomena in traffic. So one of them is that traffic jams kind of have these wave-like structures. And this kind of modeling led to innovations in traffic, like those lights on the entrance ramps of freeways, where you have to wait for the green light, and they have like one car per green light. And that was something that came out of simulation that showed that really improves the traffic on highways.
And that came out of complex systems modeling?
Well, it came out of traffic simulation, which you could say is kind of part of complex systems modeling.
Right. One of the things that I find fascinating is the human body and illness and the immune system, especially in an environmentally toxic world. So I know that there have been studies that have been done, for example, that show that if you have a particular toxin, you're 3 times more likely to get cancer, and if you smoke, you're 10 times more likely to get cancer. But if you have both the toxin and smoke, you're 500 times more likely. And there are interactions that, you know, it's a perfect example of where reducing things to their component parts and looking at individual risk factors doesn't work. Are there models of toxicity and disease in this area?
I'm sure there are.
There
one
should
off the top
be.
Of my head, but people definitely have studied sort of the genetics of cancer and how environmental factors can affect sort of the genetics. And genetics turned out to be much more complicated than anyone had ever thought. And so the genetics of disease is incredibly complicated. You know, there was this idea that once the Human Genome Project was finished, the whole human genome would be mapped, then we'd be able to figure out the genetic basis of lots of diseases and be able to treat them much better, but it didn't happen really. And that's because the genome is such a complex system, and it's so much an interactive system where genes sort of communicate with each other in certain ways and interact in very complicated ways. So I think that, you know, toxicity, environment, genetics is a great topic for complex system modeling. I bet someone's doing it.
Yeah, it's because I think, observing people who tend to be very reductionist about their diet, for example, or about their activities, and aren't looking at all their activities together. And part of the reason we're not looking at all our own activities together is we don't know how, because we don't know how these various things interact.
Yeah, no one knows. I mean, you know, you see all the different scientific results on what foods you should eat and, you know, what kinds of exercise you should do, and it keeps changing all the time because different studies show different things, and no one really understands.
And these studies study one factor,
right,
in isolation from the others.
So there was a recent study that you might have seen about low-salt diets, how they're... So one study showed that low-salt diets are harmful in terms of they promote cardiac disease. And as you say, that's just like one thing, looking at low-salt versus all the other things that are happening in the body. And it's obviously much more complicated than that.
What are some of the other things that you think are most interesting in this area that are going on at Santa Fe Institute?
Let's see. There's a whole study, interesting set of studies about conflict. There's a group there that's studying conflict in a lot of different contexts. So one of the contexts they're studying is conflict in chimpanzees and in bonobos and so on, different primates. And they have a lot of data that they're looking at and trying to sort of map out the different types of conflicts and how they can get resolved. And then looking at different kinds of human conflicts and seeing if there's sort of common principles about reducing or mitigating conflict.
When you do a study like that and you're studying conflicts in non-human primates, do researchers then interfere and try to introduce factors that would increase or reduce conflict in their primates?
I don't know if they did in this particular study, but they certainly do in a lot of studies. They try and set up situations that will, you know, induce different kinds of things they want to observe.
So in theory, we could introduce those principles into the House of Representatives.
In theory, yeah, you could find, it's all about sort of power structure, incentives, relationships, and, you know, friendship networks. That's all there in the non-human primates. It's all the same kinds of issues. So I think the scientific study of conflict could apply in the human realm as well.
Melanie Mitchell is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and her most recent book is Complexity, A Guided Tour. She's a professor also of computer science at Portland State University. Melanie Mitchell, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much.